You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show, hour two here on this Tuesday, July 5th. Hope you had a great Independence Day celebration yesterday and gave thanks for those, as we talked about in the last segment, those founding fathers who had a vision that drove them, a vision that we're still trying to come to grips with. And as Frederick Douglass said when he gave his speech, 76 years old for a man, young for a nation. I don't know about 240. We should be old enough to know better, but we're not quite. And so it's up to every generation to seek to unpack even more faithfully the promises inherent in that vision of every human being made and given inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So hope you had a great celebration, and I hope you're ready to get back in gear today. God's grace ever new, every morning, and Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever. We're going to be talking in the next segment to my guest, Dr. Stacy Trisankos. She is a PhD chemist and a homeschooling mother, and has written a lot is the editor, science editor for the Colby Homeschooling Academy. She's also worked for DuPont and some other corporations in her role as a chemist. And we'll be talking about the compatibility of faith and science. She's got a new book coming out this fall, but also an excellent essay that she had written called These Thy Atoms. She talked about how being a thorough materialist, somebody completely committed to investigating matter as it is and how it interacts, how it was being a thorough materialist that ultimately led her to faith. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. And my question of the day relates to that. What is the branch of science that gave you the most trouble in school? And in which branch of science did you find yourself most enjoying it? 573-4BREAD-4. You can call or text that number, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, or you can always post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. As I said, for me, it was organic chemistry in college that did me in, so much so that I ended up changing majors because of it. All right, let's one thing I want to talk about. My wife, a couple of weeks ago, had a yard sale, and it was for our parish, actually raising funds for a mission trip that our youth group at the parish was taking. And of course, you know, when you run a yard sale, the good thing is you can pick out some things that you may want even before you open the yard sale for purchase. And my wife is a book lover, and she brought home a few books, and one of them was a little paperback book with a very 1960s looking cover on it, a book put out by Paulist Press. Yeah, and actually a copyright came out, let's see, this came out in 1967. So it's not much to look at. And it's a very simple title, Prayer, by Hans Urs von Balthasar. Now, doesn't that a great sounding name? Don't you just sound smart when you got a name like Hans Urs von Balthasar? But I was aware of von Balthasar really for one primary reason. He was, by the way, a Swiss Catholic. One time, I think, a member of the Society of Jesus or the Jesuits, and became a diocesan priest, and ultimately was named a cardinal by one of his biggest fans, and that was Pope St. John Paul II. And as somebody, of course, who loves the life and legacy of Pope St. John Paul II. John Paul II, one who had a big hand on my own journey to the Catholic faith. Somebody who I deeply admired and loved, and I remember weeping 4 months before we became Catholic when he died there in April of 2005, because he had such an impact on me. Well, you know, any friend of his is a friend of mine. And so when I recognized his great appreciation and admiration for the Swiss Catholic Hans Urs von Balthasar, may be curious to read this book. And I'm just scratching the surface in it. And part of the reason, too, I was drawn to the book is because I always need help with prayer. If you want to talk about sciences, branches of science that you struggle with in school, that's one thing. If you want to talk about aspects of the Christian life that you struggle with, for me, it's always been prayer. Prayer is a struggle for me. Again, it's not that I'm not aware of how important it is. It's just that I struggle to do it. Whether it's my busyness, whether it's my very distracted ADHD-type brain, whether it's a misunderstanding of even what prayer is, I've struggled with prayer. And thus, I feel sort of relentlessly and perpetually guilty all the time. Mike, you should be praying more. And part of the problem with that, and I recognize this cognitively, not always interiorly, part of the problem with that, of course, is the idea somehow that why do I feel guilty about not praying? As if somehow I'm depriving God of something by not praying. No, by not praying, prayer is God's gift to me. It's not, God has no need of anything. Therefore, to not pray is to deprive oneself of the very grace of the relationship with the infinite God who is love himself. And anyway, so that's why I was drawn to this book, Prayer, by Hans Urs von Balthasar. And chapter one, which I've only, he's one of these writers that there's such, it's almost like he writes, his words are like, his paragraphs are like bouillon cubes. They're so dense with ideas that it really takes time to just kind of let them soak in the water and gradually unpack themselves. This is how his book begins. Prayer is something more than an exterior act performed out of a sense of duty. An act in which we tell God various things he already knows. A kind of daily attendance in the presence of the sovereign who awaits morning and evening the submission of his subjects. Well, he got my attention, because that's oftentimes how I've treated prayer in my life. As an exterior act performed out of a sense of duty, as though God were waiting for me to simply come and appear before him. But he goes on to say, even though Christians find to their pain and sorrow that their prayer never rises above this level, they know well enough it should be something more. Somewhere here, there is a hidden treasure. If only I could find it and dig it up. A seed that has the power to grow into a mighty tree bearing abundant flowers and fruits, if only I had the will to plant and cultivate it. Yet this duty of mine, though dry and bitter, is pregnant with a life of the fullest freedom could I once open and give myself up to it. To be a person of contemplative prayer has always seemed to me to be almost an unattainable thing. Not that I don't want it. As I've said before, when it comes to contemplation, I treat being a contemplative like George Costanza treated being an architect. You know, he always wanted to pretend to be an architect. I've always wanted to pretend to be a contemplative because I've always felt like actually being a contemplative, impossible for me. Because my prayer has seemed so much as an external act or an exterior act outside myself. He goes on to say, this is a great analogy. He compares prayer to, for many people, It's as if they had to speak a language whose rules they had never learnt. Instead of fluent conversation, all they can manage are the disjointed, disconnected phrases of a foreigner unacquainted with the language of the country. It's like in prayer, the analogy is like a foreigner walking around with his pocket translator dictionary with him, trying to figure out how to ask for a cup of coffee. He said they find themselves as helpless as a stuttering child who wants to say something and cannot. He goes on to talk about it, though, how the very words, these phrases, these little disjointed phrases that we use in prayer, even those are gifts to us. God has given us the speech of prayer. Think about the Our Father. Think about the Hail Mary. These are from the words inspired by God himself, either the Our Father through Jesus, the Hail Mary through the mouth of the angel. He says God's word, then, the scriptures, are his invitation to us to enter into the truth and abide there with him. And I'll leave you with this analogy. He said, it is like a rope ladder thrown down to us in danger of drowning so that we can climb up into the ship. So even the scriptures themselves, the word of God, the written word of God, are for us God's own rope ladder down to us that we might enter into the mystery of who he is. He's given us what we need. He's spoken. Prayer is an invitation. We'll be looking at that in the days ahead. This is the Mike Allen Show. We'll be back with Dr. Stacy Trisankos.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Fifteen minutes past the hour, you are back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Check out our full range of contributors from coast to coast at breadboxmedia.com, or you can subscribe to podcasts of your favorite shows through Podbean or iTunes or Google Play. Check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. My guest for the next couple of segments, Dr. Stacy Trisankos. She is a wife and homeschooling mother of seven with a PhD in chemistry from Penn State University and a master's in dogmatic theology from Holy Apostles College and Seminary, teaches chemistry and physics for the Colby Academy online homeschool program, and is the science department chair. She is the author of Science Was Born of Christianity, the teaching of Father Stanley L. Yockey, and she has a new book coming out in October, Particles of Faith, A Catholic Guide to Navigating Science. She works from her family's 100-year-old restored lodge in the Adirondack Mountains, where she lives with her children and two German shepherds and her husband. You can check out her website. She's got several, actually, but stacytrisankos.com. Dr. Trisankos, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Great to have you. Little bio there. A very diverse mixture of interests, for sure.
Yes, thank you. It doesn't seem like it is to me, but when you put it all down, there are a number of different areas.
Yeah, well, I'm a father of seven, so I know how crazy life can be on all those fronts. So, outstanding. Well, I want to make sure we get to this because we oftentimes run out of time. Tell us a little bit about your book that's coming out in October and what it's about.
Okay, so the book is called Particles of Faith, and it's meant as a Catholic guide, more through my eyes as a Catholic. I was a chemist before I was a Catholic, and when I came to the faith and I started to think about all the things I knew about science and all the things I was learning about faith, how I started to understand these issues. Because honestly, I never thought there was any kind of conflict. I never thought there was any problem there. It was actually new information to me once I converted that I started hearing about faith and science even being in conflict. So I started to study the issues, and the first part of the book is just a one chapter that's a brief telling of my story into the faith and how science pointed me to God and how I see science now through the eyes of faith. I see everything that we learn about in science as the handiwork of God. And so even if we don't know everything, or even if scientists are wrong, or even if our knowledge is incomplete, which it always will be, it's okay. It's not like it's a big deal. It's not like there's any conflict there. It just means we don't know everything. And then the rest of the book, after I try to orient the reader to see things through my eyes, goes into the bigger questions, like, can a Catholic believe in evolution? How do we really think about the beginning of life? Did we evolve from atoms? Does the Big Bang prove the existence of God? Some of what I thought were the biggest questions that I hear from people struggling with. And so it's not written like as a scholarly book. It's written as something that is to communicate to the public, people who maybe are not scientists, but who are Catholics with strong faith, and they want to understand these issues. And so it's kind of a starting point. So it's a Catholic guide. It's a guide for Catholics. It's not a book that tells you exactly what to think, but it's to help you learn how to navigate these issues, how to sort them out, how to understand when something conflicts with the faith and something is consistent with the faith, and how not to ever make too much of science, but to also appreciate it for what it is. So it's a how-to book.
Now, before you became Catholic, were you already a Christian, or in becoming a Catholic, were you entering into the Christian faith as well?
Well, that is a much longer story. I grew up Baptist, but I never really understood a lot of things. Like, I remember growing up, and I read my Bible every day. I read it three times while I was three times through, because my grandmother told me to read a chapter a day, and I also wrote in a prayer journal, Dear Jesus. I wrote letters every day. But
so you even plowed through Leviticus, huh?
Go ahead.
You even plowed through Leviticus.
I did. I remember. I remember because my grandmother said to do it, so I did it. I read a chapter a day, even when I didn't understand it. But that's the great thing, is I did get this overall understanding about the enormity of the Bible. And I think, I don't know, I'm reflecting, but I think that was why when I got to college and I loved science and I wanted to go study science, I just left religion behind. It's not that I turned against it, or I hated it, or I was anti-religious. It just no longer provided the answers, because there weren't any deep answers in the Baptist, you know, faith that I had found down in, I grew up in Texas. And I just sort of put it aside because it didn't have any meaning for me anymore. It seemed like a social club. So I went without faith all my adult life until my mid-30s, when I found the Catholic faith. Mm. And I only tell the scientific part in my book, and I'm clear about that. The rest of the story, that I'm probably going to sit in my rocking chair someday when I'm 90 years old on the front porch and write those memoirs down, because there's a lot more to that story.
Hmm. Well, one of the things we're going to talk about here is, which kind of connects a little bit to your life as a scientist, really before you came to the Catholic faith, an essay that you wrote called These Thy Atoms. It was an essay that won an award from the Reengaging Science in Seminaries Essay Award, which was funded by John Carroll University. And it really talks about your life as a thorough materialist. Now, we hear that phrase materialism, or, you know, the belief in matter, and we oftentimes assume that to be a materialist means that one cannot be a believer, because a materialist by definition is one who only believes in the material world. But you take issue with that and say that it was being a thorough materialist ultimately that led you to the Catholic faith.
Yes, and this is one of those things I read from Father Yaki. So anybody who reads my writing knows I have to mention his name in just about everything I write, because he really was very important to me when I started studying theology, where the pieces started falling together. But that is a term he used, thorough materialism. And it was one of those terms that stopped me dead in my tracks when I was reading. And I'm like, because what he said was the one liner was, the Catholic should be the most thorough materialist. And I was like, yes, that's exactly how it is, because if we can define materialism not as the belief that only the material world exists, but that you want to know all about the material world because you believe it is the creation of God, then it changes things around. It changes your whole orientation and how you look at it. But Father Yaki's point, and the point that I love, is that we as Catholics, viewing the world as the creation of God, we have every reason to want to be thorough materialists. We have every reason to want to learn everything we can about science. And I tell my students this, because even if you're not going to be a scientist, even if you don't think science is your thing, listen, you need to understand why the periodic table is like it is, why biological systems, you know, as much as we understand about how they work, this is how God created things. And it's profound to realize when you start looking at it that way. It's like, oh, wow. I mean, that childhood awe and wonder comes back, or at least I think it does, where you used to just marvel at the stars and the clouds. It comes back exponentially when you understand it that way. And so I say thorough materialist for that reason, because it's the handiwork of God.
You talk about that childlike wonder. You say your four-year-old has it.
Yes. I hope, as a mother, that I'm living out here in the country like we do. That is one thing. I'm so grateful to my husband for providing this for us. I hope they find that awe and wonder, and they never, ever, ever lose it. And they learn to ask questions, and they learn to dive into mysteries and seek the truth. But that awe and wonder is an amazing thing. And again, looking back and reflecting on what got me to today, I lost that awe and wonder. When I went off to college to become a scientist and I turned away from faith, I didn't realize it at the time, but I was letting go of that awe and wonder, and I was more focused inward and downward and, you know, just things of the earth and the land, and I wasn't really looking up and out. And my four-year-old, he does have that. It made me so happy when he started asking me about atoms. His sister told him, oh, yeah, everything's made of atoms. And he's like, wait, what? And he's still going through it. He's five now, and he's still going through this. Is this tree made of atoms? Yes, JJ, the tree's made of atoms. Wait, it's made of atoms. How many atoms? I'm like, well, you're going to have to learn to count to 100 before we go there. But he's like, are my clothes made of atoms? Is my arm made of atoms? Is my whole body made of atoms? Are those clouds made of atoms? And, I mean, he even like pushed me out of the way one day running to the bathroom. He's like, move, I have to go pee, Adams.
That is fantastic.
I'm like, okay, yeah, my son's a thorough materialist.
Well, we're about out of time for this segment. When we come back for the break, I want to talk more about what exactly it is about Adams that we should share in your fascination, and again, what it tells us about this world that God has made. I'll be back in a few minutes with Dr. Stacy Trusenko. So if you've got a question or a comment, 573-4-BREAD-4. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hey. We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, July 5th, feast day of St. Anthony Zakaria. St. Anthony, pray for us. Asking a question of the day, which science gave you the most trouble in school and which one did you enjoy the most? I have a feeling that my guest, Dr. Stacy Trisenkos, loved chemistry the most. Am I right about that?
I did, chemistry and biology.
I respect that because I started off as a chemical engineering major in college until I took organic, and then I was I was done.
Yeah, organic was not my favorite. Too much memorization.
Anyway, let's get back into your excellent essay, your award-winning essay, These Thy Atoms, my guest who is a chemist and a homeschooling mom and who got her PhD from Penn State and her master's in theology from Holy Apostles Seminary, Stacy Trisenkos, who has a book coming out in October as well. But this essay, These Thy Atoms, tell us exactly what it is that is so fascinating about atoms.
Well, they are, like when you're in high school, you learn that they are the fundamental building block of matter. But then you very quickly, especially these days, they know so much more, you quickly learn that the atom is not the end of the story. There's the atom itself is entire courses learning what makes up the atom, like not just the electrons and protons and neutrons, but all the particles even smaller than that that make them up, which really start to cross the line of matter and energy. And it just gets, to me, it's just mind-blowing. I mean, I sometimes just have my students think about the numbers we're talking about. I tell them one thing that I like to take them through. I call this putting on your chemistry glasses and moving yourself down into that atomic realm so you can sort of picture yourself walking around in it. It's like if you take a diamond is made of carbon that has an atomic mass of 12 grams per mole. A one-carat diamond, so we all know that. That's like a pretty big diamond. A one-carat diamond is 0.2 grams. So there are 1 times 10 to the 22 atoms. It's a 1 with 22 zeros after it. There are that many atoms in that diamond. And they're like, the students are like, oh, that still doesn't do much. I don't get it. And I put it another way. It's like if Earth's population is about 7 billion people, if we could gather all those people in the world together into a 1-carat diamond, and if those people were the mass of a carbon atom, there would be 1.4 trillion Earth populations in that diamond. And it's just, you know, it brings them into that realm that we are talking about something that is so fantastically small that you really, the human mind really cannot picture it. I mean, we have, as scientists, we have pictures we draw and models, but we're talking about a size realm that is so distantly small from us, it seems like it doesn't even matter. But on the other hand, if you put your arm up in front of you, like my son figured out, your hand is made of atoms. It's made of atoms that are made into molecules, which are made into proteins and other things. And it's all orchestrated. Like, I say this a lot, and I don't understand why everybody doesn't think this, but the periodic table ought to just make you kneel down and weep for joy, because the periodic table was discovered because these atoms, they are like they're given marching orders. They are lined up on the periodic table, one increasing proton after another. And that just blew my mind as a child, even as a student learning about it. How come every atom, as you go across the periodic table, is one more proton, one more proton? Because that one more proton directs how many electrons they have, and the number of electrons directs the chemical reaction. I mean, it's like this fundamental, amazing order underneath everything that's happening in the physical world. And then that's only the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, there used to be the idea, didn't there, Dr. Trisenkos, that the more, that the smaller you got, the more simple things became. But then with the advent of, you know, subatomic science and everything, we discovered that actually the complexity almost increases the smaller you get.
It seems like it. And you know, honestly, I don't get the word complex. Like, complex and simple to me, sometimes it seems like they're almost the same thing. Because it's a paradox. That's one thing I learned as a Catholic, too, that there are lots of paradoxes, and paradoxes make sense. That on one hand, they're simple. On the other hand, they're complex. But there is, in the simple part of the complexity of the atom and the subatomic particles, getting into particle physics, it's symmetry upon symmetry. Like, it's not just that these particles follow these laws of nature. It's that they are symmetrical. Like, you can, when I say symmetrical, I mean with mathematical equations, they order up in not just weird-looking ways, but often in patterns. And it's like patterns discovered that are discovered by the particle physicists in ways that you just never would have expected. Like, honestly, no human would have ever thought that up. And what it, you know, to me, when I took the leap of faith, it was no problem for me as a scientist saying, okay, God made all of this. That was no problem for me at all. It was like, finally, I have an answer. This all makes sense now. Science makes sense in the light of faith. The hardest part for me was the personal part, and it was really scary. If God made all of this, knowing what I knew about atoms and knowing what I knew about the structure and the order and the symmetry and the predictability, if God made all of that, and I have to also accept that God knows me, God made me with a purpose and meaning in my life, that was the scariest part to me, was the personal part. It was like it floored me. It just put me down on the ground. Like, what does that mean I'm going to have to do? What is that going to demand of me? And it wasn't that I was afraid of what the truth would demand. It was that I was afraid I couldn't live up to it. Like, what if I fail? What if I decide to be Catholic and I am really bad at faith? And of course I learned later on that that's kind of what it means to be human. Which put it all together for me, the simple and the complex. Like, to be human, it is kind of simple. We have bodies, but we also have souls. So we are both material and immaterial, and it's a unity that we can't really understand. But it's okay to be human, and it's okay to struggle with things, and we will sin, and that's what the life of faith is all about. And so it's like understanding all of that together, it's just... My students say I say this too much, but it's mind-blowing. It's just mind-blowing that God, that we have all of this. It makes life, to me, in my opinion, so exciting.
Hmm. We're here with Dr. Stacy Tresenkos, PhD, chemist and homeschooling mother, the science head for the Maximilian Kolbe Homeschool Academy, and who's got a book coming out this fall on navigating the relationship between faith and science. You talk about in your article three simple returns, basically, for anyone interested in the faith and science dialogue, how to understand the interplay between the two, between faith and science. Maybe let's run through those really quick. The first one you say is return to the first principles. What do you mean by that?
I mean the creed. Like, that was one thing, it was just a contradiction that hurt my brain at first. Like, okay, if we really believe the creed when we pray it, I believe in God the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. Like, if we really believe that, like, we go to Mass, we believe in the miracles, we believe the Eucharist, we believe in the resurrection and salvation. If we really believe this, we ought to have no problem whatsoever with science. We ought to be able to look at science and say, okay, yeah, in the light of being human, is understanding that we're human, scientists don't have all the answers. They can't have all the answers. I mean, that's just laughable. Scientists don't have all the answers. What they're doing is probing the physical world. They're trying to understand it. And in my opinion, instead of seeing science and faith in conflict, I think we, the faithful who pray the creed, should get back to those first principles and say, yes, I believe this. This is the guiding principle in my life. And we should look at the atheist who thinks science has everything and reach out to them and say, come look at it through my eyes, you know, because I know what it's like. I was never really an atheist, but I know what it's like to be a scientist and not have faith. You have this longing to know where it all came from because you're supposed to be investigating things. And that's the big question looming over your head. Where did all this come from? And so I really see the opportunity. If we get back to that first principle in the creed, I can see Catholics, in their confidence, in their faith, talking to atheists who say science has everything. The reason they think science knows everything is because that's all they've got. They need mystery and wonder and awe, and that's all they've got to find their answers. And so you need to invite them in to see you know, science, like I say, in the light of faith, invite them in. And so it, instead of it being a conflict, it actually becomes an evangelization way to bring people into the faith. Pray this creed, and now look at science. And do you see that it's so much bigger now? And, you know, to say that to them.
And you also, you make the point that along with that, and you've touched on it, that to understand that science has a particular jurisdiction, but it has limits.
It has limits. And that's where I get back to understanding the difference between, you know, science is just studying the natural world. It just studies the natural world, and it's that simple. That is the limit of science. It just studies the natural world. Science doesn't measure, as Father Yockey used to say, you can't put meaning and purpose on a scale and weigh it. It's not a physical thing. And so it's just quite simple. Science is the study of the handiwork of God, the physical realm, the nature. And that doesn't mean that's all there is. It just means that's all science can study, that physical science. That's all it can study.
Well, unfortunately, we're about out of time. It seems like when I talk to you, I could go on because you're prompting so many thoughts and ideas. Really appreciate your work. She is Dr. Stacy Trusankos. Look for her book coming out from Ave Maria Press this fall, Particles of Faith, A Catholic Guide to Navigating Science. Thanks. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you so much.
Blessings. We'll be back. This is The Mike Allen Show, and this is Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, July 5th. Get used to saying Tuesday because it's a Tuesday that feels like a Monday, but good news is it's a short week ahead. Really enjoyed my conversation there with Dr. Stacy A. Trusankos. She has an excellent blog, Science in the Light of Faith, at stacytrusankos.com. As I said, she has a book coming out this fall, Particles of Faith, A Catholic Guide to Navigating Science. As you can tell, she really has a lot to say, and I've posted a link to her article, These Thy Atoms, on the show's Facebook page. You can check it out at Mike Allen Show, and you can hear more about it. She talks about, as I said, those three returns. One was the first principles in the creed, God is creator. The second, make clear the limits of science, that science has its own proper jurisdiction. In the material world, and in that jurisdiction, it should run free and unhindered. Of course, one of the beautiful things to understand is that in many ways it was the Judeo-Christian view of the world that made science even possible, because it demystified the universe in the sense that we began to understand the universe was not a capricious, animated thing with its own mind, but it was created by an orderly God. And then lastly, she said, we need to rediscover childlike awe and wonder, which if you just listen to her talk about the periodic table, you can tell that she's still got that to a great degree. So that's pretty cool. So anyway, thanks to Dr. Stacy Trusankos, and look forward to her book, as I said, from Ave Maria Press, Particles of Faith. It saw an interesting article in The Atlantic, one of my favorite online magazines, by Emma Green, who writes on religious and social issues there for The Atlantic. This headline caught my eye. Condoms don't necessarily help teen girls avoid pregnancy. According to a new study, distribution in schools can actually increase fertility rates. Can alternative policies be more effective? Well, looky there. How about that? Something that Catholics have been saying for a long, long time. The counterintuitive truth about contraceptives, that they actually can end up having the reverse effect than what you would assume. In other words, the idea being that if we just get more contraception out there to young people, we will reduce the amount of teen pregnancy. Now, we've known that this is the counterintuitive reality for some time. Even if we just look historically, when hormonal birth control, the pill, came out in 1960, the out-of-wedlock pregnancy rate at the time was 5%. And the idea was is that now that we have more effective contraceptives, we will be able to reduce the scourge of unwed pregnancy, which was at the alarming rate of 5%. Well, now, nigh on 56 years later, the unwed pregnancy rate is somewhere in the low 40% category. In fact, I think it's still true that for women under age 30, the majority of babies born now are born to unwed mothers. Now, if we have more effective means of contraception, then why in the world would unwed pregnancy rates go up? Well, for two reasons. One is because, of course, birth control or contraceptions, I would say, because we have to be careful with our terminology, because there's nothing immoral intrinsically about controlling births per se. In other words, recognizing the signs of fertility and acting accordingly. But there is something intrinsically immoral in the Catholic vision about doing something intentionally to sterilize the act. But anyway, birth control or contraception is not foolproof. But the second issue is, that magnifies the first, is that the increasing availability and promotion and acceptance of contraception effectively increases sexual recklessness and also blurs, if not completely obscures, the connection between sex and marriage, that sex by its very nature is a marital act. It becomes, in essence, a recreational act that you try to somehow prevent from leading to pregnancy. As Emma Green points out in this piece, the logic seems so simple. More condoms, less disease, fewer teen pregnancies. This was the rationale behind a major policy push across the country in the early 1990s. According to a study published this month, though, over the course of just a few years, 22 districts in 12 states implemented this kind of programming, affecting roughly 484 schools. In about two-thirds of the schools, kids had to go through mandatory counseling to get the condoms. Condom access didn't decrease the rate of teen births, though. It seems, in fact, to have increased it. Why? Because you have said subconsciously, if not explicitly, to teens, we expect you to have sex. And so, you know, I don't expect there will be an apology forthcoming for those who have ridiculed Catholics for saying that the distribution of condoms actually increases the problem. But finally, it's nice to see it at least in a major secular publication. It's somewhat like what happened with Pope Benedict a number of years ago when he was on his way to Africa. When he was still Pope, he was being interviewed on a plane about the AIDS crisis in Africa and whether or not the church would finally relent and agree to the distribution of condoms. And Pope Benedict said condoms wouldn't solve the problem. They would only make it worse. And he was lampooned in some quarters. He was vilified in others. Even whole governments in Europe censored him and all sorts of things, because how ignorant and backward could he be to suggest such a thing? Just shows how non-scientific the church is. Well, the truth is, Pope Benedict had a pretty good grasp of human nature. Certainly in an individual sexual encounter, all other controls being, well, controlled. In an individual sexual encounter, the use of a condom, certainly, nobody's denying, would decrease the risk of the spread of AIDS. But what is the cultural impact on behavior of a broad and sweeping acceptance of non-marital sex? It leads to sexual recklessness and to, therefore, a spike in the AIDS crisis. So the same concept at work here. I'm going to post a link to this on the show's Facebook page so you can check out the article yourself. You know what? Maybe, I don't know, maybe Catholics do know a little something, crazy as that may sound. All right, let's spin up the Dial of Catechism wheel. We'll go to random.org, our random number generator. Dial up a number between 1 and 2865. And we'll see what Providence has in store for us. In this great repository of truth, knowing truth is never random, but always integrated within the panoramic totality of the faith. Paragraph is 2486. Still not dialing up that paragraph, which will not be read. Not because I don't agree with it, because it is the one paragraph that would be very awkward for family-friendly radio. 2486. Since it violates the virtue of truthfulness, this is, by the way, in the section, Thou Shalt Not Bear False Witness under the moral life, the third pillar. Since it violates the virtue of truthfulness, a lie does real violence to another. It affects his ability to know, which is a condition of every judgment and decision. It contains the seed of discord and all consequent evils. Lying is destruction of society. It undermines trust among men and tears apart the fabric of social relationships. Wow. You know, the toxic effect of a lie. It's an interesting concept that it does real violence to another. As it says here, not only does it contain the seed of discord and all consequent evils, it's destructive of society. It undermines trust among men and tears apart the fabric of social. If we don't have trust in our relationships, anybody who's ever been lied to by someone, particularly someone close to them, they know the impact. So we take our words seriously, and it's for our words which we must one day give account. Speak truth. There is no the truth and lies are incompatible. I mean, the love and lies are incompatible. Anyway, last thing I wanted to mention, another piece from The Atlantic I saw over the weekend, The Power of Casual Gratitude. I liked this a lot. It's written by Julie Beck. She says how important it is in our relationships to stop saying sorry when we should say thank you. And she got this from a web cartoon, which shows the contrast between things like sorry I'm rambling, or instead saying thanks for listening. In other words, maybe we should stop always apologizing, which we seem to instinctively do in our culture in terms of our relationships with each other, though doesn't seem to translate into long lines of the confessional, just saying. But we do apologize a lot. But she suggests turning that on its ear, instead of always apologizing, thanking the one who has loved us enough to tolerate. So instead of saying, sorry, I'm rambling, say, thank you for listening. Or instead of saying, sorry, I'm late, saying, thank you for waiting. Casual gratitude. She argues that this casual gratitude can increase your happiness and well-being. I'm going to try that today. So I have to say I'm sorry a lot, but how about thank you? Kind of turns the focus onto the other person. Worth a shot anyway. We'll be back tomorrow by God's grace. This is the Mike Allen Show, and you have been listening to Breadbox Media.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.